in their power to ensure that people's civil rights and civil rights are being respected.
The rally in Pittsburgh joins rallies across the country, including a county over in Westmoreland County.
I'm here fighting for the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all the necessities that lower income people need. I blame Congress for letting Trump run rampant over us, and we're having none of this.
Both rallies called for unity.
And there are actually so many people here in this county who believe in this country and everything it stands for. We were able to bring in, it sounds like, maybe 700 people today who are taking a stand. There are Democrats here, there are Republicans here, there are kids and dogs here. We are happy for anyone who wants to stand up against what's happening in this country right now.
This is unprecedented unity. When you see this type of unity in the city, it lets everybody know that we're going to fight back all that we can.
Now, officials with Pittsburgh police say a woman reported being assaulted in the crowd during that rally. I'm being told that police are looking into the matter. Other than that, we are told that it was peaceful and there were no other issues. Reporting in front of the City County Building in downtown, Carlos Flores.
Or listening to Public Affairs on WRCT Pittsburgh and WRCT.org.
Austin FC is off to a great start this 2025 season, and they're doing it with the help of their midfield play and new signing, Besard Sabovic.
On the latest episode of Vamos Verde, hear about the latest unheralded off-season signing that's having an unprecedented impact on the team's performance.
Plus, what would Vamos Verde be without a little lesson in Balkan history?
On the latest episode of Vamos Verde,
wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Vamos Verde comes from Precision Garage Door of Austin. From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I just think it's something that kind of came. You know, we just was able to execute. And I think the main thing I'll point to is you being able to find ways to win in multiple ways, you know. We've been able to be dominant on the ground, and we've been able to be efficient in the pass game and do what needs to be done when it needs to be done, you know. And I think over the course of our year, you guys have heard me say it, just because we don't doesn't mean we can't. And when you hear a statement like that, I think it always comes down to what is your mission? Why are you doing this? I'm doing it to win. You know, I do it to win. This team of coaches is just to do the same thing. That's what it's about. You know, I'm not going to look back at anything and remember anything that someone said about me or an opinion that was had. I'm going to think about the championship that we won.
Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Jalen Hurts. Hurts was voted the winner of the Pete Rozelle Trophy awarded to Super Bowl 59 Most Valuable Player. The Kansas City Chiefs didn't make history on Sunday, February 9th in Super Bowl 59. The Philadelphia Eagles denied them the chance to become the first team in the 59-year Super Bowl era to win three in a row. Instead, the Eagles dominated the game from the beginning to the finish to finish with a 40-22 victory. Hurts was at his best, completing 17 of 22 attempts for 221 yards and two touchdowns, and added 72 rushing yards and one touchdown on the ground, the most rushing yards by a quarterback ever in a Super Bowl. It marked the 34th time that a quarterback has been named Super Bowl Most Valuable Player. Hurts became the fifth quarterback ever with multiple touchdown passes and a rushing touchdown in a Super Bowl, and the first quarterback ever to have at least 200 passing yards and 50 rushing yards in multiple Super Bowls. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, highlights of Super Bowl 59, In Black America.
It's a journey, you know, it's all a journey. And I've still yet to arrive. We still yet to arrive as a team. We just enjoyed everything, put forth the effort, and it's taken us here. You know, there's no destination to it. And just tons of gratitude, like Coach spoke on, just having a tons of gratitude. And I've challenged myself, we challenged ourselves really just to lock in on focusing and having that focus and being able to finish. And you get so focused in, kind of like, you know, it's not over till the fat lady sings, you know, until the clock hits zero. And it required that level of focus. And so when you're in that mode, you know, you're processing everyone coming to dap you up, and just my innate state and my personality and my competitive nature, I don't do well when everybody's congratulating the game ain't over. But it was a joyful moment.
The Super Bowl is one of the biggest sports events around the world. Every year, two teams compete to their maximum potential and determine who's the best. The last time the Super Bowl was in the Crescent City, the lights went out for 34 minutes. Super Bowl 59 was played on February 9, 2025 at Caesars Superdome in New Orleans. It was the 11th Super Bowl played in New Orleans and the 8th in the Superdome and the first since Super Bowl 47 in February 2013. In a rematch of Super Bowl 57, the Philadelphia Eagles defeated the Kansas City Chiefs 40-22, securing their first Super Bowl championship since Super Bowl 52, 7 years earlier, and second overall. The Eagles' win prevented the Chiefs from achieving the first ever Super Bowl three-peat. Philadelphia quarterback and Texas native Jalen Hurts was named the game's most valuable player. There was a lot of talk about the rematch between the two Texans and African-American quarterbacks. In his first news conference before the big game, Patrick Mahomes talked about the culture Andy Reid had built.
I think more than anything, you see the opportunities that you get, and you never know what's going to be your last one. And to be able to be in the Super Bowl again is always special. And so for me, just being hungry to be as great as I possibly can be, not only for myself but for my teammates, and knowing how blessed I am. So it's been a heck of a run, and hopefully we can continue as my career goes on. I feel pretty much the same. I think you stay so busy here that you don't really realize the magnitude of the game that you're playing. I think it comes with the experience, knowing what the week presents, knowing where you're going to be at, and then try to keep it as close as you can to the routine that you always have. So we're excited for the game, and we're excited to get back to more and more higher leverage, higher level practices, and get ready to go out there and play our best football. It starts with Coach Reid and the culture that he's built. But I think through this entire team, you have a lot of guys that love the process of starting it from the bottom and having to build your way back up there. And we understand what it takes to get to the Super Bowl, and we know it's not easy. And so instead of just trying to go out there and go through the motions, guys know that they have to put this work in and to get to this position. And so, like I said, it starts with Coach Reid and the culture that he's built. But I think that the team has a lot of guys that want to do what it takes to win. Not necessarily. I think what I've always said in my career is that, for me, success is leaving everything you have on the football field every time you have the opportunity to, if that's practice, if that's games, OTAs, whatever it is. And I don't want to have regrets at the end of my career. And if I can go out there and feel like I progress and I know that I'm putting everything I have into a football game, that'll be a successful career to me. Yeah, I mean, extremely talented. But I think from watching the tape, especially watching the games that he played against the Eagles this year, it was cool to even see his progression throughout the season from the games that he played. And you could tell he got better and better. And that's what you want to do in the NFL is you can be talented, you can make all the throws, but can you progress and can you learn what defenses are doing to account for you and get better from that? And it seemed like he did that all year long. And it's going to be just the start of a great career. So extremely talented, great football player, and deserves all the honors that he'll get. I mean, every time I've played Coach Fangio, there's been different changeups and different things that he's thrown at us. And I think that's what makes him so great is he's not going to just do exactly what you saw the last time. And so I'm sure there'll be blitzes in the game. I'm sure there'll be times where they play coverage. It's going to be a chess match, and you want to go up against the best, and he's one of the best defensive coordinators in the NFL. And it'll be a great challenge for us as an offense and as a football team. Just knowing that it's kind of like that win or go home mentality that you have in the playoffs. You have to go out there and execute at the highest level and the highest leverage positions. And I think Coach Reid has prepared us for those moments in training camp and throughout the season. He puts us in situations where we have to make those big plays. And so I think the preparation prepares you to go out there and execute at those high leverage moments like fourth down. I think more than anything, you just focus on the guys around you. I've played in a lot of harsh environments. In Buffalo, in the cold, with the fans against you, or in Denver or Oakland or in Vegas. I mean, you always have fans that are against you in some of those away games. And so you focus on your teammates. You focus on going out there together, and it kind of builds even a closer brotherhood of, you know, it's kind of you versus everybody. And so I think it just comes with the experience that you just go out there and just be who you are. I was always looking for the big play, and that had a lot of success. It was a lot of fun to watch, but I feel like now I can kind of focus on the successful play. And you want to still hit those big plays and have those big touchdowns, but whenever it's not there, getting to the check down or the guy underneath and letting them make plays for us. And so I think that's been my biggest progression throughout my entire career.
Kansas City Chief quarterback Patrick Mahomes. Selected in the first round of the 2024 NFL Draft by the Kansas City Chiefs, Xavier Worthy became the first Texas Longhorn alum to score a touchdown in the NFL's championship game. In fact, he scored twice, and in doing so, he set the record for the most receiving yards by a rookie in Super Bowl history with 157, which passed the previous record of 109 held by Chris Matthew and Torrey Holt. Also, he is only the second player to have 150 receiving yards and multiple receiving touchdowns in a Super Bowl. Worthy talked about playing in the championship game.
Man, just the main thing for me was just going out there and just being the best me and proving everybody wrong and showing I could be in this and play in this league. Man, like you said, randomly two guys and three guys went out, man. It's weird, but that's how this game goes, and that's what we signed up for. So this next man up mentality, and I feel like Coach Reed and the guys and D-Hive, the guys that he brought in, and Travis Kelce and Pat, they really helped me out and just gave me that confidence to go out there and ball. Yeah, they just mix up their coverages, make sure nothing got past them. So, I expect that a lot from defenses. So, really, my game's improved on the underneath stuff. So, they're going to have to figure it out now. I feel like just the confidence and all the information I was learning from the vets, all the little things, all the nicks I could have got better at, and I just improved and improved every week. Man, just like I said, little nicks of the game. Rather, that's my route. Just understanding coverages, when to do things and when not to do it. So, Hollywood's a guy that's kind of like my stature, so I really listen to him a lot about a lot of things to do. I mean, not really. The main guy I just really listen to is, like I said, Hollywood and Trav. I mean, those guys got a lot of football under their belt, so just taking everything they say in. Yeah, I mean, just embrace it, take it in. Make sure you take care of your body. Most importantly, you got a game in a couple days, so whether that's drinking water, getting your treatment, getting your rest, so just stand off your feet and making sure you're good for the game. Yeah, man, that kind of gave me flashbacks to, like, a bowl game in college. So it's cool just to have that back and bring us back to, like, our college days. Yeah, man, I feel like Texas belongs in the SEC. I mean, they kind of proved it this year. They're going to keep proving it, and next year should be a good one for them. Yeah, they're really good DBs. They got a good, savvy vet over there like Darius Slay, helping Quinyon out. Quinyon's a really good corner, so he has Slay to really learn off of. So they got a really good unit over there. Just my growth. I feel like I've been growing each and every week, learning new things, whether that's on the field, off the field, just becoming a better man and a better player. Yeah, 100%, man. Coach Sark ran that kind of NFL system already, so coming from that, and we practice hard every week, so it was basically nothing changed coming into Coach Reed office, man, so everything was the same. Oh, man, they're really good corners. You wouldn't even look at them like they're rookie DBs, man. They go out there, their physicality, they're confident. They play good football. They're a good unit. Yeah, really smart, really confident in his game. A good tackler. He's an all-around good player. Yeah, man, I still feel like a rookie low-key. A lot of growth, a lot of aches and pains, but I feel like all over the season I grew over time and became a better player all around. No, I don't. I'll go. It's me, Hollywood. I'll go TQ, and I'll go Marshall Washington. Of course, they know that. They know I'm ready to race. Man, shout out to my Canadian fans out there, man. I always wanted to play hockey. I'll say me. I don't know the positions of hockey, but I wanted to play. Yeah, I mean, Pat, like, his game is just like he's an all-around competitor. Whether that's off the field, he's competitive in the meeting rooms. He's competitive off the field. He's a dog. Whether he's hurt, he's going to go out there and compete and give his best shot. Yeah, man, Pat, man, he's an all-around player, but nobody gives him credit for how much of a team player he is. But he looks out for his teammates on Christmas. He gave the whole alignment, like Louis bags and stuff like that, so it's cool. And just he plays through injury. A lot of stars, they kind of, when they get hurt, they're like, okay, I'm going to save it for my career. But Pat goes out there and gives it his all the time, so just kudos to him. Man, like you said, this growth, man, and I got to give credit to the guys that really helped me, like Travis and Hollywood and D-Hop. The guys really helped me and gave me, like, wisdom to become that receiver I am now. Man, Trav's at one of the best at just finding the open spot and getting open and sitting down in the zone. So just picking his brain with that and understanding when I can sit and when I have to keep running is the main thing. Man, I appreciate y'all, man. All the waking up earlies, all the stop crying, man. So just all that, I feel like my family really pushed me to get to this moment. Yeah, man, Texas, man, freshman year, popped onto the scene freshman year, and then my sophomore year kind of maintaining, and junior year I kind of solidified it. And then coming into the draft, ran that 4-2-1, broke the record. It was a crazy moment to have that. And then to get drafted to the Chiefs is a surreal moment, because that's a team that everybody wants to play for, one of the best quarterbacks of all time. So just having the opportunity and now being in the Super Bowl is a blessing.
Kansas City Chief Wookiee wide receiver Xavier Worthy. You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Kristen Cabrera, reporter-producer from the Texas Standard. One of the coolest things about working on the show is getting to tell stories from my community, like this one I did on high school UIL mariachi. But you know, this is Texas. You'd be hard-pressed to go a week without hearing dun dun. Listen anytime to the Texas Standard, wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to this episode of In Black America. The Philadelphia Eagles began their NFL season against the Green Bay Packers in Brazil. They went 14-3 in the regular season, won the NFC East, and earned the number 2 seed in the NFC playoffs. They defeated the Green Bay Packers, the Los Angeles Rams, and the Washington Commanders to reach Super Bowl 59. The Eagles were making their 5th Super Bowl appearance. This was the 2nd Super Bowl berth in the past 3 seasons. Signing Saquon Barkley was the best move the Eagles made during the offseason. He ran for more than 2,000 yards, becoming the 9th player to do so and earning the league's Offensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, a lot of people don't really understand how big we are in pass pro. You know, we're extension of the line, so understanding the scheme and who's a point and who's our guy who we're responsible for, and making sure that we're inside out and trying to give the quarterback a clean pocket. There's been a lot, and I can't really just say one person. I think the beauty of that would be this team that we have, whether it's, you know, me, Paris Campbell, AJ, you know, just having all those conversations is kind of it's kind of our biggest conversation starter, asking questions about religion and asking questions about faith, and it just helps you grow and learn even more. And so, yeah, it's not just one person I could pick to that, and that's something that I'm trying to continue to improve on. I've never thought about it that way, but, yeah, with all the things that's going on with AI, I mean, you never know. That could be a possibility. The way I kind of look at it, maybe, like, with it'll take away the first down markers and all the stuff that it comes with the human eye. I could see that kind of being a place, but I don't think coaching and stuff like that will ever be affected by it. Penn State's been everything for me. That's the reason why I went there. You know, even if I didn't turn out to be an NFL player or play in the biggest stage, I knew that the alumni there would be a great spot for me for after football. But yeah, being there during that tough time and, you know, kind of being part of the teams that helped bring Penn State and put Penn State back on the mat taught me so much. Taught me so much about adversity, taught me so much about never quitting, and just continue to believe in the program, continue to have faith. And, you know, I'm just happy that, you know, to be part of Penn State, and I wear that proudly. Yeah, I think it's important for sure. Having guys like BG, Lane, Jalen, Smitty, all those guys that's played in the game. But I've been playing football since I was 7, 8 years old. You know, obviously it's just on a bigger stage and, you know, it's more eyes, but, you know, it's still set hut and you got to go run the ball. Someone asked me that the other day. I'm not quite sure. I know there wouldn't be a better gift than winning on Sunday, though. I think not just for me, but just for the team, and understanding that, you know, that it's a business trip. Have fun, embrace it, especially early in the week. But when it's time to go to work, it's time to go to work. So I think that's been really important. I think we've been handling that pretty well, taking it all in. You know, even whether it's, you know, coming here and doing media and not being here, like, man, like, oh, I got to do this. Use it as an opportunity to expand your platform. But when it's time to play the game, and when it's time to be in practice, when it's time to be in meetings, make sure that we locked in and refocus. He's a great back, super physical. I think everyone just focused on how physical he is, but he got some shiftiness to him too. And I know he battled a little injuries early in the year, but he's playing at a high level, and he's been doing it for the last two or three years, so proud of him. I know he's still having his phone, but I saw that on IG not too long ago. But, yeah, that picture kind of makes me feel old. Well, yeah, that's a great question. My question would kind of be just, how do you get your mentality to just focus and locked in those big moments in those games? And, you know, you could see highlight clips in those moments, how he was just stone cold face, always ready and prepared for the moment. So that would be my conversation with him. Like, what would be some tips that you use to get in that mode? I would say definitely help my career out. That's why I wanted to come here. I think I said before I even came here at the end of my press conference or my goodbye, whatever, when I was in New York, that I feel like there's still a lot left in me, and I feel like I still can still make a chance to be one of the best running backs to ever play, and coming here has definitely helped. And then it works when you have the chemistry on this team, the love that we have for each other. There's so many superstars, there's so many well-known names on this team, but all we want to see is each other, you know, go out there and play at a high level. So it's a beautiful thing. Yeah, I got a lot of current boxers I like to watch. My favorite right now would definitely be Shakur Stevenson. But going back to the first part of your question, I mean, boxing is kind of its own sport, it's an individual sport, but I think the mentality is big, and it's a team sport, but within the team sport, you got to win your one-on-ones. So that's where I try to lock in and focus, and I have an unbelievable offensive line and unbelievable coach that put me in a lot of positions to win my one-on-ones. And when you're getting that, it's got to be a killer mindset. You got to go in there and kind of go for the KO. Yeah, I definitely thought about that. You know, that's what you want to do. When you come to place, you want to leave your legacy. You want to have an impact. But the kind of best example of how I look at it is, when you think of Marshall Faulk, do you think of the Colts or do you think of the Rams? That's my goal, to be here, leave my legacy, and just thankful for what happened the first six years I had in New York. But also, I still can be in the Ring of Honor and have my legacy and be known as a great Eagle.
Philadelphia Eagle running back Saquon Barkley. Super Bowl 59 marked the ninth Super Bowl rematch ever and the second time that two teams have met in the Super Bowl twice in the three-season span. Jalen Hurts had been shaped by the adversity throughout his career. In 2016, he lost the college football championship game as a freshman at Alabama and then was benched at halftime the following year in the title game and could only watch from the sideline as the Crimson Tide won a national championship. He spent the next season as a backup before transferring to the University of Oklahoma, where he improved as a passer and was drafted in the second round by the Philadelphia Eagles in 2020. Hurst became the eighth quarterback all time to start multiple Super Bowls in their first five career seasons.
Playing with purpose, this is what I'm called to do in this season of my life, and I'm gonna give it all I have and try my best to leave no stone unturned.
Jalen, was that part of the game plan from the beginning that you could throw against the Kansas City Chiefs and go long with your receivers?
It was just something that kind of came. It was something that kind of came. I just think it's something that kind of came. We was able to execute, And I think the main thing I'll point to is you being able to find ways to win in multiple ways, We've been able to be dominant on the ground. We've been able to be efficient in the past game and do what needs to be done or when it needs to be done. And I think over the course of our year, you guys have heard me say, just because we don't doesn't mean we can't. And when you hear a statement like that, I think it always comes down to, what is your mission? Why are you doing this? I'm doing it to win. I do it to win. This team approaches it just to do the same thing. And that's what it's about. I'm not going to look back at anything and remember anything that someone said about me or an opinion that was had. I'm going to think about the championships that we won. It's about us. It's about us and how we approach things. And it's never getting too high, never getting too low, and just processing it. You got to be able to use these experiences that you've had in the past, because they're all formative for the future. And I think we've been able to do that. I think we've been able to do that. So I give a lot of credit too, man. I think just from a chemistry standpoint, that all those Georgia guys and all the familiarity we have on our team, how the defense plays, they've had that continuity for a very long time. And so I think they've been able to carry that on from Georgia to Philly. And honestly, the same thing on offense, being able to build off of prior relationships and be all in on this one thing, you know. And I know Saquon's new to the bunch, but we've all watched him play throughout his college career. We've always known the type of player he is, the best back of our time. And let's put it all together. Put it all together.
Hey, Jalen, David Andrade with Eco Sport. We saw you having a moment with your family after the win. What does it mean to them having this big win for you?
We'll see. I know everyone's excited. Everyone has been there along the journey, too. You know, everyone's been there along the journey. It's been a ride. It's been a fun ride. And I've embraced every step. You know, I took great pride and never backing down from a challenge. Always turning my negatives into positives, turning my weaknesses and making them my strengths. And it's taken great effort and determination to evolve my game over time and just continue to grow and improve. And I know my family's been there every step of the way.
Jalen, Andrew Greenstein of Louisiana Radio Network. In college, the first time you played for the College Football Playoff Championship, or the BCS Championship, I should say, you lost that game. You were benched in the game that Alabama won. You went to the Super Bowl 2 years ago. You didn't come out on top then. You finally come out on top now. Just talk about the perseverance. You were talking about your ups and downs earlier in this press conference. The perseverance now that you have finally made it to the top of the mountain.
Not normal. So it's been a very unprecedented journey, and the journey's, you know, it's always the beginning until it's the end. And I think means a lot. Quantifying all that work over the years, embracing everything, taking every challenge head on, and taking every joy and moment of achievement and success head on as well. Processing them all as one.
Hi, Jalen. Congratulations. So your phone screensaver has been you seeing the confetti drop from the
Chiefs. You know, and when I think about that, that wouldn't even post them. You know, they had their phones on the team meet, you know.
Are you going to change it now that you have pictures of yourself in the confetti winning?
I don't know. Maybe it's something I need to stay there so I can come back here.
Jalen, how important was it to jump out to such a commanding lead in the first half against the team that seems to always squeeze out close wins?
Well, I think for us, we've been able to win in the multiple ways. And it was just really about taking it a play at a time. You know, I look back on previous games and in previous years, and, you know, you want to put a high value on finishing, having great focus and finishing, you know. And think about the last time we were in this game, we were up 10 at halftime. And, you know, they played a hell of a game to get back into it. But we wanted to put a high focus on finishing it the right way, and it took a team effort.
Vicky Jones with VMH Sports right here. So Patrick Mahomes just said literally a few minutes ago he knew you would be back. That's one part, and how you feel about that. And the second part is you spoke of it again, purpose. If you've had a moment to think about it, or if you thought about it beforehand, how has this win added to your purpose? The first being, again, Mahomes, what he knew about you, and how this has added to your purpose.
I got a ton of respect for Pat and everything he's been able to accomplish. Always a pleasure competing against him. Utmost respect to him. And I think in the end, you know, things come right on time. And, you know, the last time around, it wasn't our time. It wasn't my time. Sometimes you have to accept that you have to wait your turn. You know, and dealing with all the, you know, everything that came with the last Super Bowl, you still kind of leave it empty a little bit, because as great as the performance was, it wasn't enough to win. And I think going through those emotions and processing those things and processing that experience lit a great flame in me and enhanced my desire to win significantly. And so, ton of respect for Pat, ton of respect for the process and what it takes, because all I can think about is all the work and the purpose never changes. I think that, you know, your values never change. You know, I think in the end, it comes down to how people look at you. I'm gonna always be the same guy, you know, and I was telling someone earlier, I'm that same kid that came, went to the national championship and lost and went back and, you know, got benched and had to transfer and had to go through this just unprecedented journey. And that kid always kept the main thing, and always was true to his vision and what he saw. And it all began with great leadership, really began with really just doing it the right way, trying to do it the right way and do the right things. Kind of went into a set the example type of thing. And now I give a lot of credit to my parents and that just putting this the type of work ethic in me that they have. And like I said, it's only the beginning until it's the end. And the end ain't coming anytime soon.
Philadelphia Eagle quarterback and Super Bowl 59 MVP, Jalen Hurts. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You're going to hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Over 20 years ago, I'd say, Rick and I were doing Black Talk Radio, which is completely different than Mr. Rogan and Jim Quinn and some of these other people out here. Black folks on the radio are very expressive and very, just like some of the white broadcasters, opinionated about some of the things that they talk about. But they hold no holds barred in expressing themselves. They don't mean to like insult or infuriate people, but they're very expressive in their talk when they talk about what's going on here in the nation. And it's changed over the last 20 years, and now more people are definitely involved with social media than they were back when Rick and I first started broadcasting. And here are some examples of this. So check it out.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black, but I'm going to keep it brief. This will be my second time getting on this platform telling somebody to fix Senator Cory Booker a plate. Get him a foot bath. Book him a massage. Pass the collection plate down to the church house. Get my man's one of them fancy ergonomic desk chairs and a beanbag for his office as he deserves. First time I told y'all to fix him a plate was for the simple act of bold kindness he displayed speaking life into Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson during those turbulent confirmation hearings they put her through 2 years ago. Some of you all called that performative given his past, but somebody needed to display pride and protection for powerful black women, and it just happened to be him. Now I am once again urging the people to fix him a proverbial plate. Give him your thanks if you see him, and show him some damn gratitude for one of the realest, most selfless, courageous, demonstrative acts of resistance ever displayed on the Senate floor, most certainly in our time. Because Republicans have been ambling about the executive and legislative branches unchecked, supporting the chaos Donald Trump and Elon Musk are orchestrating every 45 seconds, Senator Cory Booker filibustered on the Senate floor for 25 hours and 5 minutes. In doing so, he broke the previous 24 hours and some change record of a man whose name isn't worth saying, who tried to prevent the Civil Rights Act from coming into fruition. That's poetic justice. Melly Grant could never. To speak out against what he called the grave and urgent threats posed by Trump administration's policies, he did not sit, he did not eat, he did not use the restroom, and he was able to speak with clarity, provided receipts, citations, testimonies, meaningful critique, and significant monologue for over 25 whole hours and an additional 5 whole minutes. And I said it 2 years ago, and I say it again. I love you, black man. Oh, but it was just performative. Performative, performative, performative. Shut up! up. Damn. Do you even know what performative means? Y'all learned one little vocabulary word and ran into the ground. You want to know why he didn't go to the bathroom? Not just because those are the rules and he just held it in for the people. Because he prepared for it. This man stopped eating 2 days before the filibuster and didn't drink the whole day before. This man literally fasted and prayed for y'all and y'all still typing think pieces. Now is not the time. We quite literally have bigger fish to fry, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't hold his feet to the fire on the things you disagree with. During his brief presidential campaign, we learned a number of things about him. Yeah, he was a charismatic mayor from New Jersey who still lived in project housing, responded to tweets from his constituents, and was seemingly down for the people, but we also learned that he was instrumental in the expansion of the charter school system up in Jersey, one that benefits many children and parents, but also leaves funding for public school teachers, facilities, and overall resources to be desired. We learned prior to his campaign that he accepted funds from pharmaceuticals, often aligned himself with big money bridges, that he was against giving all prisoners the right to vote, and that instead of advocating for radical, wide-sweeping prison and sentencing reform, his ideas were more moderate. That doesn't preclude him from having the ability to show up and show out. Did you ever think that maybe Senator Cory Booker was not meant to be a front-running presidential candidate, specifically so he could be positioned to do this one thing, this one time, that we all could get behind? I said time and time again that it is our job to vocalize our concerns and to give pushback where it's needed, but we also got to be willing and ready, for that matter, to give just as much energy when the going gets good. This was a historic moment, a sacrifice made in the interest of millions of Americans. And yet he quoted quite a few people to help get his points across. Dr. King, obviously. John Lewis, obviously. But Senator Cory Booker was not standing up there by himself either. Dr. King was standing right there with him. John Lewis was standing right there with him. Frederick Douglass, Fannie Lou Hamer, Sojourner Truth, Shirley Chisholm, Ida B. Wells, the nameless ancestors' voices who we can't remember were standing right there with him. And if he didn't earn your respect, we should be able to hold sacred space for the work they did to hold him upright in that moment, because this was not just for show. And it was not just about him. After his filibuster, 5 Republicans voted with Democrats against Trump's tariffs, and that's changed. Special elections did not result in us taking back the House. And with this authoritarian regime underway, the strategy cannot just be to wait until we can get a party that's bigger and badder. We got somebody who isn't just kissing Republican ass and bending the knee, but effectively working to dismantle the hegemony from within. And I'm going to call on my good sister Hope, again, if you forgot about her, but she has to be the one to guide you in this moment. Not contempt, not contrarianism. I'm not asking you to forget. I'm asking you to be constructive. Give credit where it's due and lean into forward motion. This is the kind of behavior that we have been asking for. Just because it comes from a vessel that you don't see fit doesn't mean God don't mean it for good. And I can tell you right now that that is most of our testimonies. So if everyday people are capable of changing their minds and shifting their trajectory, we got to give our leadership the opportunity to do the same.
Hi, Native Land Pod. Hi, Andrew. Hi, Tiffany. Hi, Angela. I love you guys. Thank you all so much. I just have one question. What is the goal of Project 2025? What are they wanting this country to look like? I read the book 1984 by George Orwell, and it's this dystopian America. It sounds like that's what they're going, but what are we suffering through? They want us to suffer. They want us to, you know, ride this wave, but they're firing, you know, a million federal workers. They are pulling back regulations. They're defunding and canceling, you know, the education. And it's like, what is this country supposed to look like when you're all done and said, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? But like, what is this world? What are we supposed to look like? What are we supposed to do? But thank you all for all that you do. Love you. Bye.
I love that. That's make right. Orwell fiction again. Make Orwell fiction again. That is the mantra, honestly, that so many of us have been saying. Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's really, it's scary to see what happened. And I love this question, speaking of special interests, because I think that is the special interest that had such a huge impact on the campaign, is having a huge impact on the country. I got to say, to me, the goal of Project 2025 is Black folks. I think we are at the center of all of this policy, of all of this hatred. It is a concentrated effort.
I heard
effort.
That wrong. I was like, wait a minute, what?
It's a concentrated effort to oppress and suppress.
Yes.
And it is making me revisit the entire conversation that can we even coexist here? I was recently having this conversation about, you know, when President Abraham Lincoln said we should get rid of the Black folks. Like, we cannot coexist with them. And I have to say, I think he may have had a point, because he essentially said they will never forgive us for enslaving them, and white people will never want the stain of slavery around them. So let's give them some money and ship them out of America. And you look at us hundreds of years later, and I think it has always been a bitter battle in this country, because we are the keepers of America's memory. And so this anti-Black discrimination has a wide impact and cast a dark shadow across so many areas of our politics. and they were able to convince other people to hate black folks too. And there were certain people who are now considered white, but they didn't have white privilege. The Italians weren't considered white for a while, and then they got white privilege. And the fastest way to get that is to hop on hating black folks. So I think we are at the center of all of this discord, to be honest with you.
You know, when I heard this question, one, thank you for the brilliant question. We do love you too. We started the show with Malcolm X, you know, a prophet in his own time, talking about that they will change what is happening to say that the people who are the recorders and documenters of accurate history, are not ahistorical, are not revisionist history tellers, will be made to seem like they are the actual haters. Mm-hmm. And I think that accountability is not hate, even though it's uncomfortable. And, you know, when I think about the question, because we did a whole podcast on Project 2025, what is it? What is its origins? Thank you to all of you who watched it. It's one of our biggest shows.
Please visit it again.
Please visit it, especially for the underpinnings of Project 2025 to the point of the question. But I think the fundamental question here is, what do they want the country to look like? You know, what does the country they imagine include us? Does it include brown people? Does it include the actual founders of this space, people from Indian country? Or does it exclude everyone because they think white is right? You know, do they think the Make America Great Again? I remember they did this poll around the 2016 election about what was the era, right, that you want to get back to that demonstrates when America was at its greatest. And these motherfuckers went to the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, they went to the pre-civil rights era. And what I got to tell you guys, and I don't want to disrespect our predecessors at all, but I think that we almost in 1950 right now in 2025. It feels like they rolled back all of these rights. I'm not going to say his name, but I had a really interesting conversation with a thought leader among us right now who said, you know, what I think we have to pay attention to is we spent all this time focusing on civil rights advancements, our voting rights, affordable housing, fair housing access, equal opportunity in employment and education. And they were able to roll that back in less than 2 months. Mm-hmm. So if we were to examine where we put our focus, to the same point that Congressman Rangel raised upon his retirement from Congress in a CBC meeting, he said, have we spent too much time focusing on social policy and not enough on economic policy? The reason they are able to advance in these ways at our expense is because they can afford it.
Andrew, Angela raised a really good question. Yeah. I'm curious your thoughts. Have we spent too much time advancing social policy and not economic? That was Mr. Rangel's.
That's what it was a conundrum. You could see the pain on his face. Like, and Mr. Rangel and I didn't agree on every single thing, but he's a CBC founder. He was a part of the group that sent the 61 recommendations to Richard Nixon. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them focus on social policy. Even the way that we approached housing access was about what was fair and just.
Yeah.
And not about giving us the resources to afford to be where they are.
Right.
Or even to be where we are.
Because it didn't matter how much.
But that's the thing. And right now, it doesn't matter how much. Because they are able to lock us out of all of our progress. And it's a damn shame. Mm. You know, that's what I'm saying. I'm not trying to disrespect our forebears. But I do think we got to wrestle with this. Because as we prepare for a fight, and as we lean into what it means to persist, resist, and oppose, what is the right lane? Do we go right back to protecting voting rights and civil rights and all this? Or do we go into fighting for our own space, our own dollars, our own access, our own communities so they can't take it away? I don't know.
Well, I want to hear from you, Andrew. As I toss to you, I want to say we did that. So we, when we carved out a little tiny space for ourselves in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, they weren't bothering anybody. These are people who were living their life. And they found it and killed us. The U.S. government, they bombed the shit out of us. You know, they came in and murdered women, children. It was state sanctioned murder violence. So there is something inherent.
It wasn't just Tulsa. That's true.
Right. That was not the anomaly. That was the norm. Because years prior to that, the Red Summer of 1919, it was rampant violence across this country aimed at black people, black communities. So, Andrew, I don't know that I don't know that it can be one or the other, mm-hmm. or should we be fighting for both, or does this even system of capitalism ever serve us? Mm.
I mean, with due respect to the congressman, I actually don't believe that the fight has been social exclusive. I actually think the values that brought us to the fight may feel social, racial, and gender parity so that we can compete. But compete for what? To compete for jobs. To compete for schools that would educate our children and make them qualified for the positions that paid higher wages. We fought for fair housing so that when folks went out and worked a full time plus days of work, that they could then invest in this economy by affording to live where it is that they work. When our foreparents fought for much of the social safety net, I would argue practically all of it is economic in nature. So I actually believe that while our fight has been informed by our consciousness around fairness and ending discrimination, it has all been toward the end goal of being able to earn a wage that you can live on, take care of yourself and your family, and have a vacation every once in a while. So that's just my slight exception, and folks may land on different sides of that. And then to the question around Project 2025, I'll say two things. One, I think part of its goal was to turn what we right now associate as a democracy with three branches of government helmed by an executive branch. They would like to create what they discuss as the administrative. They want to get rid of what they call the administrative state, and which is all these agencies running things. And they want to create the unitary executive. All powerful, all being exempt from criminal prosecutions, who can make decisions unilaterally to shut departments, yeah. to decide whether to enforce laws, so on and so forth. So they argue a very different picture of what democracy looks like than I think how most of us conceive of it. But I would argue that their belief is probably closer to where the framers were. Remember, the framers didn't give everybody the right to vote, not even all white people. It gave all white property owning men the right to vote. They did not believe largely in direct democracy in the sense that you vote for the person and whoever votes the most for that person wins. No, they thought that the emotions of the people, the emotions of the general public needed to be muted or at least the edge taken off by a more sophisticated, smarter, intelligent, a richer group of white men who could then calm the passions of the people. So they
you're
have
literally
a different
describing what's
view.
Happening today. This is
exactly.
wild.
Because that's exactly what they believe in. It's been the belief since the very beginning. And then the second part of the response on Project 2025 is to say they hold, I think your point, Tiffany, was right that black people, but I would argue that it's been black people and eliminating us as a productive part of this society by virtue of what conditions exist that allow our uplift in the first place. What do I mean? I believe that they are intent on destroying the entirety of the social safety net. Social Security, they were not for it when it was proposed. Yeah. It happened because there was a Democratic president and a super majority Democratic Senate. When we think about retirement benefits, They don't support that. When you think about Medicaid, Medicare, they believe in this mythology of the survival of the fittest, that whoever survives were the ones who were fit and meant to survive. Donald Trump told us that in the first administration. He said the people who are affected mostly by COVID are folks who are already sick, are older, or are the black people. They said that.
Yeah.
He said it from the White House. Yeah. Right? So I think where they want to go is back to a time where if you had means and wealth, name and privilege, this country was for you. And anyone who didn't have that in their possession, you fell by the wayside. Oh, you can't afford retirement? Fine, you sleep on the streets. Oh, you can't afford to get health care? Then die. Yeah. I don't mean to be dismissive in any way or cute by one half. This is their vision of the country. And through Project 2025 and the dismantling of all of this, they are well on their way to trying to achieve the kind of country that they believe should have existed in the first place.
Well, that gets to this question of special interest, though. Angela, you were looking into special interest when it comes to members of Congress. And I to Andrew's point, that is something that is not talked about. I keep saying it every podcast. I'm not going to stop this podcast. It is such a gross failure of American media and journalism that we don't talk more about that and highlight who is funding some of these members, because Project 2025 was funded. You know, it came out of the Heritage Foundation, but there are people funding it. This presidency is funded by a sole immigrant, for the record, not an American citizen, who bought the presidency for this man. He's funding, you know, a lot of pieces. He's defunding the government while funding his own special projects through the government. And members of Congress are
funding him.
Right. And the government funding him. And members of Congress are standing by watching this happen amidst, you know, some of these angry town halls. Why on earth would that be? And as you talk to us, Angela, I think it's also important to explain the laws around it, because this was a big part of Citizens United. There used to be caps on how much you could contribute to a member of Congress, and individually, what I think is 2,500. Do I have that wrong?
Yes, but it's a 5,000 max. What'd you say?
No. The numbers may change, but you're right. There is a cap.
So as an individual, max, I can only give 5,000 total to any candidate.
There's a thing per
per cycle. Reporting.
Yeah, per cycle.
Yes, per cycle.
For a primary and
primary.
General.
2,500.
You know what? Let me look, because I'm trying. Okay. I was trying to look up something. I actually don't want to go down this road because I have a lot on the special interest piece. But I want to, let me, since it was brought up, I'm going to get the facts right.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure it's 5,000 for a PAC, and it's different for an individual.
I bring that up.
But what's the individual federal contracting contribution limit? Federal contract.
So 3,300 per
primary
election.
And then general. Yeah.
Okay.
Per individual, and a PAC can do 5,000 in a primary and 5,000 in a general for a total of 10.
But it's unlimited for us.
That's different. That's an independent expenditure, which brings us back to Citizens United. Carry on.
Yes. So super PAC. I don't know if you all could hear our producer Lolo off camera was giving us some good info. 3,300 for an individual during a cycle, 5,000 for a political action committee. And when, you know, the Citizens United ruling, I mean, it essentially changed campaign financing, and that is a huge challenge in this country. That is a debate for another time, but I wanted to at least introduce that so we could understand why some of these people, why you have private interests controlling how our government functions.
This has to do with something more precious, which is, who are we as a country, and what values do we stand for? And now, this is not just an abstraction, and I think this is one of the challenges that we have. And I saw this even before the last election. I think people tend to think, democracy, rule of law, independent judiciary, freedom of the press, that's all abstract stuff because it's not affecting the price of eggs. Well, you know what? It's about to affect the price of eggs. One of the things that has distinguished us in the past has been this basic idea that we are a rules-based society. What that means is that, you know what, I can support one candidate instead of another, and I don't have to worry that the police are going to come harass me or my customers. That's what happens in other places. That's what happens in Russia. You know, we take for granted the idea that we don't have to pay bribes or hire somebody's cousin in order to get a business permit. That's how we built the economy we did. That's why this place worked. And it has very concrete impacts on all of our lives. So, this is the first time I've been speaking publicly for a while. I've been watching a little bit. let me just close this portion of my remarks by saying it is up to all of us to fix this. It's not going to be because somebody comes and saves you. The most important office in this democracy is the citizen, the ordinary person who says, no, that's not right. I do think one of the reasons that our commitment to democratic ideals has eroded is that we got pretty comfortable and complacent. You know, it has been easy during most of our lifetimes to say you are progressive or say you are for social justice or say you're for free speech and not have to pay a price for it. And now we're at one of those moments where, you know what, it's not enough just to say you're for something. You may actually have to do something and possibly sacrifice a little bit. So, yeah, if you're a law firm being threatened, you might have to say, okay, we will lose some business because we're going to stand for a principle. If you are a university, you may have to say, figure out, are we in fact doing things right? Have we in fact violated our own values, our own code, violated the law in some fashion? If not, and you're just being intimidated, well, you should be able to say, well, that's why we got this big endowment. You know, we'll stand up for what we believe in, and we'll pay our researchers for a while out of that endowment, and we'll give up the extra wing or the fancy gymnasium that we can delay that for a couple of years because, you know, academic freedom might be a little more important. For most of human history and to this day in most of places in the world, there is a cost to challenging the powers that be, particularly if they're abusing that power. And this idea, and I've noticed this among some wealthier folks who, you know, after George Floyd, they were right there, and a bunch of companies were talking about how they cared about diversity and they wanted to do this and they were all for that, and they are mute right now. But what that tells me is it was okay when it was cool and trendy, and when it's not, not so much. And that, I think, is what we have to, each of us has to examine in our own hearts. Is all right, we say we're for equality. Are we willing to fight for it? Are we going to risk something for it? We say that we're for rule of law. Are we going to stick to that when it's tough, not when it's easy? We believe in freedom of speech. Do we stand up for freedom of speech when the other person talking is saying stuff that infuriates us and is wrong and hurtful? Do we still believe in it?
From Pittsburgh to Philadelphia to Phoenix, protesters take to the streets all across the country today. The so-called hands-off demonstrations sending a message to the White House and the Trump administration. Pittsburgh's Action News foreign reporter Carlos Flores tells us thousands of people here want their voices to be heard.
People were here in front of the city county building earlier today protesting the recent actions by the Trump administration, joining many more across the country.
It was a simple message voiced by thousands. Hands off.
We're here to say hands off our country, hands off Medicare, hands off Medicaid, hands off LGBTQ lives. That as normal Americans, this is not normal.
The rally in downtown was put together by Indivisible Pittsburgh, along with several other organizations, including the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers, the League of Women Voters, and Casa San Jose. Many people speaking on how President Donald Trump's first couple months in office should raise concerns. Mayor Ed Gainey attending today's rally and voicing similar frustrations.
My office will do everything in their power to ensure that people's civil rights and civil rights are being respected.
The rally in Pittsburgh joins rallies across the country, including a county over in Westmoreland County.
I'm here fighting for the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all the necessities that lower-income people need. I blame Congress for letting Trump run rampant over us, and we're having none of this.
Both rallies called for unity.
And there are actually so many people here in this county who believe in this country and everything it stands for. We were able to bring in, it sounds like, maybe 700 people today who are taking a stand. There are Democrats here. There are Republicans here. There are kids and dogs here. We are happy for anyone who wants to stand up against what's happening in this country right now.
This is unprecedented unity. When you see this type of unity in the city, it lets everybody know that we're going to fight back all that we can.
Now, officials with Pittsburgh police say a woman reported being assaulted in the crowd during that rally. I'm being told that police are looking into the matter. Other than that, we are told that it was peaceful and there were no other issues. Reporting in front of the city county building in downtown, Carlos Flores.
WRCT Pittsburgh, your oil revival station.
Will you describe the 1961 incident at Payne College in Augusta, Georgia, and tell us what happened, what you did?
Well, I'm just kind of a weird. My thing is always been, my attitude was,